In 1953, many were hooked immediately on Leslie's unprecedented mix-and-match style, which at times comes near to a kind of literary vision of a much later multimedia age. We have history, and the closely focused present day in terms of a burst of spleen against Dr. Donald Menzel, the prototype for today's super skeptic Philip Klass. We have a scream about politicians, accusations about a conspiracy of silence, topped up by sightings from those who possessed good sane bourgeois credentials. Leslie quotes 7 well-authenticated UFO sightings published originally by Time and Life magazine International on May 5, 1952. He combined successfully his skillful seed-editing of the ideas of Charles Fortz with the power of a new prestigious mass-market magazine. The fully referenced information also impressed a very literate readership. The 7 sightings Leslie gave as examples were all from groups of well-educated technologists. The first example was to become one of the classic UFO sightings, retold in great detail many times since 1952. At 9:10 p.m. on August 25, 1951, Dr. W. A. Robinson, professor of geology at Texas Technological College, stood chatting to 2 of his colleagues in the backyard of his Lubbock home in Texas. They were Dr. A. G. Arberg, professor of chemical engineering, and Professor W. L. Ducker, head of the Department of Petroleum Engineering. On a night which was clear and dark, suddenly all 3 men saw a number of lights race noiselessly across the sky, from horizon to horizon, in a few seconds. They gave the impression of about 30 Luminu beads arranged in a crescent shape. A few moments later, another similar formation flashed across the night. This time the scientists were able to judge that the lights moved through 30 degrees of arc in a second. A check the next day with the Air Force showed that no planes had been in the area at the time. The scientists agree that in order to explain the silence of the objects, it must be assumed that they were at least 50,000 feet in the air, in which case they were going not 1,800, but 18,000 miles per hour. Other sightings are given by a leading American astronomer, a group of 5 technicians from the Office of Naval Research, some technical writers for the Aerophysics Department of North American Aviation, the captain of a DC-3 airliner, and the crew of a B-29 bomber over Korea in 1952. Up to this point in flying saucers have landed, there are no signs of mystical Tibetans, secret doctrines, or sparks of cosmic fire. But they arrive with a vengeance in flying saucers and sound, saucers for a song, and saucers over Atlantis. All this disparate matching, texture, and direction resulted in a book, quite unlike anything written prior to 1953, apart from Charles Fort's 1919 Book of the Damned, which had by 1953 become an obscure out-of-print book, like Fort's book, which has now been rediscovered. Flying saucers have landed has the right to claim masterpiece status, with textual planes rather like the distortions of a medieval map. There is also the early warning of a postmodern nature, that the ordered Cartesian perspectives of the Ordnance Survey may almost certainly possess similar distortions. As Charles Fort pointed out, many anomalies of which the UFO is but one variety, live between the folds of such cultural warps, as do the banished sea serpents of old maps. These still appear to baffle, hypnotize, and infuriate. This is, of course, the traditional fairy role as pointed out by Jacques Vallée in Passport to Magonia, and Patrick Harpur in Demonic Reality. Clara John was the editor for Flying Saucers Have Landed. She was certainly a master of her profession. Even though written by different and sometimes unacknowledged hands, the notes to cache chapter and bibliography are fully integrated, and refer to one another rather like a prototype computer menu. Given 2 very different writers, and a subject that is moving in all directions at once, securing such a tight organization for the book was no mean achievement. The notes at the end of each separate chapter refer to Adamski in the third person, and were almost certainly written by Desmond Leslie for both books 1 and 2. These notes also form part of a commentary on the main text, which acts as a kind of subtextual stabilizer to Leslie's often wild speculations. they ground him by means of good, solid references. Thus the whole editorial apparatus contributes in no small way to the impression of the book as a fascinating mix of ever-varying planes of reference within past, present, and future. Within this mix there is a cross-referenced fine shading between fact and fiction combined with objective references from many authors, both past and present. The notes to each chapter contain a brilliantly inspired mix of ancient history, contemporary newspaper reports, quotes from mystical tracts and non-Christian religious texts. This was a heady cocktail for Britain in 1953, where some streets were still lit by gas lamps, some direct current public mains electricity still existed, and the nearest thing to an avant-garde author was Terence Rattigan. This technique was lifted by Leslie almost whole and entire from Charles Fort, but to give Leslie his due, in the foreword he does acknowledge his debt to this author. What Leslie did, which Adamski would hardly have been capable of, was to take Fort's occasionally cumbersome style and give it a popular update. The result was a reader-friendly streamlining in which John Warrell Keckley's perpetual motion machine and the mystical power of the Great Pyramid follow breathlessly on the heels of saucer sightings over American atomic weapons establishments. 54 In a special sense, Flying Saucers Have Landed is a book about books. The bibliography alone is a treasure house of lost, forgotten, out of print, and abandoned texts of a beleaguered underground culture. Just one of the charming things about Leslie and Adamski's book is the way it sent book hunters in droves looking for such titles as Alice Bailey's The Consciousness of the Atom, 1922. Other titles for dedicated bibliophiles included Noah's Ark by W. J. Crowe, Some Human Oddities by E. J. Dingwall, and The Self and Its Sheaths by Annie Besant, who was always a sucker for wonderfully unconscious titles. Other books are about the riddles of prehistoric Britain, Atlantis, Indian religious mysticism, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and the obligatory Tibetan religious teachings. Many of the books mentioned may have been on Adamski's own shelves, including the Theosophical Publishing Society's The Solar System by A. E. Powell, 1930, and The Pyramids and Stonehenge by A. P. Sinnett, 1924. Throughout many generations the ideas in such books had retreated before science and industry like fairies and elves had fled before Christianity. That they remained half-glimpsed forms beyond the outer rim of the cave-mouth fire of the mainstream culture. There, like frozen viruses under polar ice, they awaited their opportunity for a climate change. When it came, narrow streams of such obscure and almost forgotten books 55 moved rapidly toward the delta mouth of Leslie and Adamski's creation as if they were masses of Charles Fort's damned and rejected knowledge under sudden marching orders. Flying Saucers Have Landed literally reincarnated such fustian material, brushed off its tombed dust, and introduced it to the brave new world of what we now call image bytes. As such it was one of the first New Age books, and without it such influential books as Bergier and Powell's Morning of the Magicians, John Mitchell's Flying Saucer Vision, and Robert Anton Wilson's Luminatus would have been impossible. To a large extent, Leslie did what Charles Fort did some 40 years previously, but Leslie was a far better salesman. He goes at breakneck speed for almost every piece of whimsy at once, literally showering such gems like free gifts at a supermarket convention. No wonder Leslie got on with Adamski. In essence, the dynamic young ex-fighter pilot was an American mank. There was to be no fustian British thought for him. Much of the source material used by Desmond Leslie to build a new vision of the world had lain almost unnoticed in mainly limited editions and privately published works, the annals and collections of papers of obscure folk societies and occult groups, and individual students of all matters esoteric. The Nazis had looked in these same directions too, and had found power there, but used it for evil and destructive purposes. Many of the people who were involved in this obscure literary undergrowth were almost unknown 19th and early 20th century scholars or academics. Quite a few of these books were written not by professionals, but by people of private means, many of whom abounded in a very different age to our own. These people were in the main like the optical astronomers of the 19th century, looking for particular orchid gardens in a leisurely manner rather than being pressured for results, as is the way in our own society. Therefore, rather as Shakespeare used Holinshed, and Chaucer used Plutarch and Boccaccio, Leslie's achievement was not only to bring together this most obscure material, but to synthesize it dramatically, and in his case, relate it all to the modern technological manifestation of the flying saucer. In 1954, the British publisher Frederick Muller issued Flying Saucer from Mars, an extremely well-written book 56 by Cedric Allingham that included photographs of an Adamski-type saucer, which he said that he had taken near Lossiemouth, Scotland, on February 18, 1954. Allingham shows that he also was influenced by the books of Charles Fort, and his work is one of the earliest discussions of flying saucers have landed. He was one of the first to appreciate what Leslie and Adamski were talking about, particularly the connection of Leslie's material from the past with Adamski's contact story. Flying Saucer from Mars is useful because again there is a discussion of some immediate reactions to the publication of Flying Saucer have landed the previous year. Though the top American scientist Donald Menzel had published the extremely skeptical Flying Saucers in 1953, Menzel didn't stop the idea of saucers just catching the final era of what Allingham calls the music hall comedians, who sang of flying saucers, teapots, and other phenomena. There is perhaps is no single modern phenomenon that is still looked upon as futuristic, yet can be traced back to the time of the music hall. Here is Desmond Leslie, writing in the 1970 revised edition of Flying Saucers Have Landed. Ever since the cliché flying saucer was coined, the greatest and most exciting mystery of our age has been automatically reduced to the level of a music hall joke. The comics of vaudeville and the comedians of state and science banded together, most successfully, to encourage humanity in its oldest and easiest method of escape to laugh at what it does not understand. It is interesting to note that of all people, Arthur C. Clarke, writing in the Journal of the British Interplanetary Society, made a strong attack on Flying Saucers Have Landed, calling it deplorable, and a farrago of nonsense. Clarke, then hardly known as the famous fiction writer he would become in later years, thought the photographs were all faked. However, he added, if flying saucers do turn out to be spaceships messers, Leslie and Adamski will have done quite a lot to prevent people of intellectual integrity from accepting the fact. In other words, the tribal chiefs want to get their hands on the cargo first. In another passage, Clarke says that the perspectives in the photographs are wrong. But Allingham points out that by the time Leonard Cramp in his classic Space, Gravity and the Flying Saucers 7 had shown that the proportions were without a doubt correct, the then young radio astronomer Professor Bernard Lovell, he of later Jodrell Bank fame, suggested that the best thing to do with the complete edition of Flying Saucers Have Landed would be to take it up as ballast in the first spaceship and dump it overboard in space. The reigning astronomer royal, Sir Harold Spencer Jones FRS, who wrote an article entitled Now Bury These Flying Saucers, endorsed this opinion. In this, he said, it is time the question was closed forever. By comparison, the review in the Observer of October 4, 1953, by Charles Davy was intelligent, well-balanced, and left the question of truth or falsehood open. A letter of October 11 from G.G. Cooper introduced the question of lampshade similarity. Charles Davy replied, one might have thought that anyone who wanted to support a tall story with faked photographs would have managed to make them look more plausible, more like an imagined spacecraft and less like a lamp. The material in the longer book won by Leslie quite overwhelmed the provincial and conservative British scientists at the time. Neither the education nor the scholastic background of these very British scientists had prepared them for such wide and original thinking. One can appreciate their difficulty. The harsh public schools of those days and the experience in many cases of two world wars were experiences enough. By the time of the 1956 Suez disaster, and the utter failure of the first British space program, the aging senior British scientists of Adamski's time belonged to a totally exhausted generation. given such initial reactions in Britain, it is strange therefore that interest in flying saucers have landed took root in what appeared to be somewhat infertile soil. But as always, the surface of a society is deceptive. Even in Ur Britain, there were live underground streams running rapidly toward the more receptive times of the 1960s. In the 1950s, interest in occult philosophy, fringe religion, and metaphysics in general was perhaps at its lowest ebb in European history. Many valuable libraries, manuscripts, and much historical material had been destroyed by the two wars, and the gradual cultural marginalizing of all matters esoteric had been going on since the decline of 19th century spiritualism and the public perception of the behavior of such characters as Aleister Crowley. The young men and women who came out of the armed services and voted against Churchill in the 1945 election formed the rump of a new class whose practical and rational views were mainly left of center. Even those who were not of this political persuasion, nevertheless believed in science and thoroughgoing rationalism as tools with which to construct a new society. Neither left nor right wanted anything to do with esoteric matters, which in Britain in particular had never been liked nor understood. To almost all of this generation, the occult was a standing historical joke, hardly entering serious British discussions. At best, it had something to do with Catholics, upper-middle-class eccentrics, and faces well south of Calais, or at its worst, it was associated with the Nazi philosophy of mystical racism. With Crowley and Blavatsky long booed off the cultural stage, the talk after 1945 was of economics and socialism, of realism, and the demystification and demythologizing of elite social structures and antiquated Victorian ideology. The first phase of this decision to change experiences received was brilliantly successful. In Britain, there arose the welfare state, a quite revolutionary concept of socialism and society. It seemed that in the face of this achievement alone, applied scientific thinking was indeed historically triumphant, and many of the old ghosts sowing historical and philosophical confusion had been banished forever. But the deeper reason for the success of flying saucers have landed was that many utilitarian rationalists still had bad dreams. The problem was the Nuremberg trials of 1945. It was impossible to describe Nazi crimes by conventional legal concepts. The events as examined could not be rationalized, could indeed be called hardly criminal at all. There was therefore hesitancy on behalf of the prosecution, exploited by the still defiant, if somewhat deflated, Goering, for two reasons. The first difficulty was that most of those on trial appeared to be genuinely bewildered by what had happened, as if they were coming out of a dream. The second was that as the trial proceeded, it became very clear that a highly astute native German intelligentsia, including some men of genius such as Walter Heisenberg, had been involved in forming an operational ideology that had caused the death of over 30 million people. Plainly, what was on trial was not violence as conventionally accepted. The Fabian utilitarianism of even brilliant men such as Q.C. Hartley Shawcross hardly equipped them to examine motive, when that motive involved intellectual corruption of an order whose scientific objectivity was a new kind of demonology, although previously Churchill, with his usual far-sighted vision, had described Nazi science as perverted. Perverted it was, if only because it justified the sort of medical experimentation on human beings that can hardly be described, and that was quite invisible to the normal processes of law. Such a thing was also invisible to the normal processes of historical examination as expressed by traditional academic historians such as Trevor Roper or Alan Bullock, with their extremely limited social democratic view, and even the far more venturesome William Manchester and William Shirer, who both thoroughly despised metaphysics. Concrete empirical methods were no tools for analyzing an inspirational force that passed through all moral walls as easily as strontium 90, which by the time of Nuremberg, was steadily entering the bones of both the guilty and the innocent alike. This feeling of unease as the Nazis were tried and hanged almost as simple-minded horse thieves, was a justification for Desmond Leslie to take a second look at esoteric matters that had long since been thought historically dead. though it was certainly not directly intended as such. Flying saucers have landed can now be seen as part of a counterculture reaction against Marxism and the puritanical terrors of the beginnings of the Cold War in Europe. Both right and left were against all free creative imagination, whatever form it took. Though the Nazis accepted the power of imagination via Wagner and Nietzsche, they perverted it, while the communists attempted to destroy it utterly. Thus, like Alice in Wonderland, Flying Saucers Have Landed has an implicit political background. Though Leslie lacked Charles Fort's depth, range, and literary skill, he had nevertheless an ability to combine complex irony with bizarre humor. Other highly influential books such as Morning of the Magicians and the books of Princely LaPoa Trench were inspired by Leslie's achievement in turning obscure folklore into modern cultural dynamite. The whole approach in Flying Saucers Have Landed is bright, lively, and most informative, though the book lacks Fort's poorly hidden political anger and bitterness at the non-recognition of his undoubted genius. Certainly it struck a brilliant light in those depressing pre-60s days, which were a kind of no man's land between the end of World War II and the far happier world of the 1960s. Although sophisticated books on UFOs such Flying Saucers Are Real by the American writer Donald Kehoe had begun to appear in 1950, Leslie's approach attached the saucer phenomenon to history and the development of ideas. This was something that Kehoe, as a very dour and practical ex-marine pilot, was not inclined to do. He rejected all contactee claims as outrageous leaks, and threw Adamski out of the group he headed, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Leslie's book was also much more dramatically appealing than The Riddle of the Flying Saucers. The first British book on flying saucers by Gerald Hurd, published in 1950. Hurd's otherwise intelligent and interesting account is marred by his theory that the crews of the flying saucers were nothing less than intelligent bees. Believing this, Hurd, unlike Desmond Leslie, could hardly include contact stories or abductions. For the same reason, he could include no historical background, and the reaction to the suggestion that the pyramids were built by superintelligent bees can be imagined. These were just a few of the reasons why, in comparison, Flying Saucers Have Landed became by far the better seller. This tells us something about humanity in general and avid buyers of such books in particular. Abductions by humanoid forms perhaps, but by bright bees, no. At the end of Leslie's chapter 20, the first spaceship on record, the time is ripe for the entry of one of the most celebrated white rabbits of the 20th century, one George Adamski. After quoting from the Brahman tables, Desmond Leslie gives George a build-up straight out of Ben-Hur. I now hand over the tale to George Adamski, who is the first to be able to give us a documentary record of his experiences and impressions on coming face to face with a man from another planet. Adamski was not afraid when he saw the shining vehicle come down, nor when the tremendous realization burst upon him that he was standing face to face with a living spiritual being, a man like ourselves, a human brother from another globe of existence. And so we who are of the same flesh and mold as Adamski can look up with joy, rather than fear, when from time to time other fragments, other people, sparks from the same flame, flash for a moment into the orbit of our perception, knowing that, like ourselves, they are working out the full lesson of their worlds in the slow, anonic, struggling ascent toward union in the central mystic Sunday. Finally, the man himself comes on stage. I am George Adamski, philosopher, student, teacher, saucer researcher. My home is Palomar Gardens on the southern slopes of Mount Palomar, California, 11 miles from the Big Hale Observatory, home of the 200-inch telescope. In contrast to Leslie's florid descriptions and often quite breathless enthusiasm is Adamski's almost monosyllabic style. Such a contrast had hardly been achieved before in one book, or at least with such aplomb. The cool and calm nature of Adamski's entrance, after such an introduction, comes as a pleasant surprise. Expecting some kind of crazy monster of a mad eccentric, instead we encounter a home and a life, we meet friends and acquaintances. Again, in contrast to Leslie, we meet many folk of differing opinions. Present is the landscape and atmosphere of the California mountain communities. There are cameos of its life and characters. Its weather, climate, and atmosphere are well drawn. From the very beginning, Adamski raises an almost aboriginal sense of something about to happen in this region of the world. And UFOs apart, after 1945, something tremendous did happen. From Los Alamos to Los Angeles, there developed what was tantamount to a new renaissance in culture and scientific thinking. Brains drained off from boneheaded traditional cultures whose speed of thinking was at the rate of cavalry before the advent of the tank. The bizarre contrast of personality, background and style of the two authors is surprisingly effective. The Adamski experiences come over as an intense personal dramatization of one of the historical periods described previously by Leslie. The result is a surprisingly successful unity. Read Adamski and you have to take Leslie with you, and vice versa. It creates an intriguing tension in the reader. The ideological jumps of Leslie we can handle, but the physical jumps of Adamski, well, perhaps we are not nearly so sure. But Adamski writes surprisingly well. His voice is clear and extremely matter-of-fact. He was obviously a stable person, almost devoid of hysteria, depression, or the schizoid tensions of fundamentalist believers. When he describes his first contact with what he believed was a man from an extraterrestrial spaceship, the mystic in him is awed into silence, and his description is plain and naturalistic, deft, and most careful. His point of view is outward-looking. He mentions people and places by way of illustration. There are meetings with a wide social range, and opinions are exchanged. He travels, corresponds, and has good personal relationships. He has, for the most part, a balanced temper and a patient and scholarly disposition. He lived very happily within the busy commune-style society, of which almost all spoke well of him. Neither does he appear to be devious or secretive. 66 Thus there is no psychological base for saying that Adamski was the kind of unscrupulous fraud he has been accused of being by many who have not given him his proper due. He was simply not complicated enough for the kind of sophisticated multi-dimensional duplicity in vilfing many photographs and films of what would certainly have had to have been extremely sophisticated electromechanical models. Neither was he technically devious enough to accomplish the simultaneous and complete deception of no less than 6 witnesses to his initial desert contact. We must take note here of a good rule derived from Charles Fort, and not make any explanations more fantastic than the thing they are trying to explain. However, by his description of the desert contact, we can see the source of the problems that were to plague Adamski for 20 years, and bring him near to poverty and despair. He was simply an absolutely appalling optimist, and a rather camp sentimentalist to boot, amongst other things. But he related a tale that the world was never to forget. Chapter 5. Orphan's Shoes and Mr. Silas Newton. Flying Saucers Have Landed does not end with Adamski's story of the original desert contact on November 20, 1952. Both the postscript and appendix contain a mix of mad comedy and intrigue, and the latter contains unexploded bombs, some of which have only just detonated after ticking away for half a century. The postscript certainly sounds as if it was written by Adamski. It gives an account of the prevailing situation regarding the interpretation of the marks on the soles of Orphan's shoes, of which plaster casts were made by George Hunt Williamson at the time of the desert encounter. As ever, Adamski is wonderfully unconscious of himself as a human being. He says without the least hint of comic irony that great efforts have been made to interpret these marks, as well as the strange writing on the photograph whose frame was dropped from the spaceship's porthole on December 13, 1952. And he adds without the slightest blush, "I learn that not one of the workers feels within himself that he has been fully successful in learning the messages to be passed to Earthmen. It takes some nerve to initiate a crazy game of interpreting the marks made by the shoe soles of a being who claims he came from Venus in a flying saucer. It must have taken even more nerve to believe in it himself, as Adamski did, certainly. Though his sense of humor was not all that strong, it is difficult to believe that he did not smile to himself on occasion as he introduced this game to the world, and sat back and watched the world work on it. The mad metaphysical comedy he created in three dimensions is straight from the pages of Joyce or Stern, with a touch of Edward Lear.